Welcome to Voices of NCAJ. We're talking to members of the North Carolina Advocates for Justice about what it means to be a trial lawyer, what it takes to be great at the practice of law, and how being a part of NCAJ enriches their lives and careers. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Welcome, everyone, to Voices of NCAJ, the podcast for the North Carolina Advocates for Justice. I am Amber Nimix, your host and Director of External Affairs for NCAJ. Before we get started, I'd like to thank our Circle of Leadership members for supporting NCAJ's mission and this podcast. If you're watching on YouTube, you can see a list of Circle of Leadership firms at the end of the podcast. And to find out how your firm can join the Circle, go to ncaj.com/circle. My guest today is Annabelle Rosa. She is the principal attorney at Rosa Lawyers in Durham and this year's recipient of NCAJ's Annie Brown Kennedy Award. The award, which was presented to Annabelle at convention in June, is given for commitment to acquiring full freedom for all citizens of North Carolina and exceptional advocacy that protects individual liberties. It recognizes active service in the local community with a focus on the status and welfare of families and minority citizens. In his nomination of Annabelle, NCAJ past president Kevin Bunn praised her as a passionate advocate, particularly on behalf of the Hispanic Latino community. The more difficult the environment comes for causes, the harder Annabelle fights. Annabelle, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such an honor.
Congratulations on the Annie Brown Kennedy Award. That is one of the highest honors that the NCAJ can give. It honors the legacy of Annie Brown Kennedy, who, as you know, was a trailblazing advocate and litigator in the civil rights and also personal injury areas. So it was well deserved, and it was to see you there with, you had a whole crew who came to like be with you as you're honored, and that was really exciting. And in your acceptance speech, one of the things you talked about, and one of the things that the Kennedy brothers, when they presented the award, recalled was your experience of being a young college student who moved from Puerto Rico to Syracuse. Tell everybody listening what that was like for you.
Now that I think back on it, some of it was naivete, being naive, embarking in such a huge trip to go by myself. I was 16. I turned 17 the first month while I was in Syracuse. And I went by myself. I mean, my father took the trip with me, but then he left me there and I was 16. And I did not speak English. It was quite an accomplishment to register for my first semester without saying a word. I mean, I understood what was happening, but in order to speak, you need, you know, a couple of months, 2 or 3 months. And I did that. That was quite an accomplishment.
Had you been to Syracuse to visit before you decided to move there? You just, so many young people are intimidated by the thought of like, you know, just like going away to college at all. What drove you to decide that you were going to do this in a completely different language?
I had big dreams. I come from a typical Puerto Rican family, and the way that Puerto Rican families for many years, because of the way the economy worked in Puerto Rico, a lot of families went to New York. You have to talk about my parents to understand all of this. My father went to war in the Korean War when he was very young. I think he was 16 when he was in Korea. And when he came back, he had a previous family when he was very young, and that family was in New York. And then my mother was really a trailblazer herself. She got her master's degree when women didn't even go to college because there was very little money. The money was going to be saved for the men to go to school. So she had a scholarship, and my parents met in college, my father with the GI Bill and my mother with a scholarship. And so I saw that, and I think that I absorbed that. So I had big dreams. I wanted to speak English like my older brothers did. I did visit with them when I was 15, and they lived in Brooklyn. I had a taste of, you know, what it would be like to live in the big city and to have big dreams and go after something bigger than whatever I had witnessed.
And when you got there, you had three majors, is that right?
Yes, I couldn't decide what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to do something with media, I applied for a few schools. I was accepted. Actually, most of them. But Syracuse attracted me because of the communication school. And they also offered me a very good, you know, I still had to pay, but it was, and they were very helpful. You could get there, I think it was 2 weeks before everybody else, to become acclimated, and they were very helpful. That's how I decided on that program. But then, yeah, I still wanted to do literature because I love literature, and I wanted to do something in communications. So I ended up with a lot of credits and had three majors.
Your first job, or one of your first jobs out of school, was as a TV reporter.
This is correct. I was not looking for a job as a television reporter. I wanted to do something with my production degree, because my degree was in television production, but that's the job they had available. And I wanted to work in New York and live in New York. And I said, that's what I'm going to do. So there I was with a camera and a cameraman and, you know, doing stories in Spanish for a Spanish television network.
Wow. How long did you do that job?
I think I did that for a couple, maybe 2 years, a year and a half. And then I met Mayor Dinkins. I'm not an on-camera. I always end up doing things on camera or media related, but I didn't see myself as an on-camera person. I also, you know, was in New York at a time when there were riots. There were riots in California. There was a lot of racial unrest. And the message that David Dinkins brought to the city at the time was something that I really resonated with, because he spoke of New York as a gorgeous mosaic. He didn't describe it as a melting pot. His vision of New York was a place where you bring in your little piece and your color and what you bring from you, where you come from, and all of them together make New York and make New York the great place that it is. It's the way I have always felt about our country. You know, the United States. That's how the vision that I had. And so I resonated with him, and he invited me to join his press office. I was very happy to oblige.
How long did you work with Mayor Dinkins?
So when I went to work with Mayor Dinkins, he was not mayor yet. So it was an exciting time to join. He was a borough president at the time. You know, a group of young people and people of all ages. I kind of received a lot of education from this group of people. I think of them as my first family in New York, a family outside of my family that embraced me and took me in and educated me in a lot of things. And so I grew with that group. And eventually, after the campaign, we moved into City Hall.
That's amazing to have been able to step into New York and have that be the group that you became a part of. That must have been incredibly formative.
So I worked with him for about 7 years, maybe eight. I have to tell you, it was the best. I say that about a couple, maybe two or three jobs. But I mean, I was in my 20s. My job was to, I was part of what they call the advance group. So a group of people get to anywhere where the mayor is going. You get there in advance of him, like in maybe an hour before he does. And so you know what's happening in the room where he's going to come in. You know who is there. If there's press, you find out what they want to know about. You find out the answer to what they wanted to know. When he gets there, you sit with him and you tell him, hey, when you come in this room, this is who's going to be there. And if there are members of the press, you tell him what they want to know about. And if he wants to know more, you tell him who knows more. And you provide him with all the information so that when he goes in the room, he is able to provide all this information. And so I shadowed him. I was able to go to all the Grammy Awards. I flew helicopters every day. I was in all the tennis games. It was the greatest job for a 24-year-old. It was like, how am I going to ever beat that? You
know? Right. How did you transition from that, like, which sounds amazing, to what led you to law school?
Part of my job was to write speeches for the mayor, anything that had to do with the Latino community. And there were other areas that I would write. Like I chose to do housing, things that I was interested in at the time. If I felt like every time that I had a question, I had to check with an attorney. I also felt like the education that I was coming with from Puerto Rico in terms of constitutional issues, or there were so many areas that I thought, where could I learn these things? And it fit in with going to law school. And I mentioned it to Mayor Dinkins. I remember like it was today, we were flying over Boston Harbor with the mayor of Boston, I think, or a senator. And there was another person in the airplane. And I said, I think, Mr. Mayor, I've been thinking about going to law school. And forget it. It was his campaign. Then he was, because he had met my parents and he had said he and his wife, Joyce, they were going to take care of me. And he would not stop. He said, Annabelle's going to law school. So that.
Once you manifested it, there was no turning back.
The cat's out of the bag. And so it was hard to leave the job, but I knew it was the right thing to do. I knew that he wasn't going to be mayor forever. I wish he was mayor for longer than he was. Then after that came Mayor Giuliani. But I think I did the right thing. And I think that they knew it was the right thing for me.
Well, did you practice in New York or where did you go to law school?
So I went to Brooklyn Law School and I took the New York bar and the New Jersey bar at the same time because you could do that at that time. So you would take the bar in New York, which it's an experience. I mean, there's ambulances waiting outside at the Jacob Javits Center because so many people pass out. I took the bar in New York and then take the multiple state the next day. And then you cross the river and take the test the next day. So they would schedule them that way. And I remember my hair was falling, like flying around. My brother drove me to the second test and he's like, what's wrong? I said, what do you mean what's wrong? I just took two bar exams back to back. I couldn't fail it. That's what I was saying at the event. I could not fail it because I wouldn't have had the money for to pay my rent. So I was like, I have to pass one of these two tests, but I passed both.
Not everybody can say that, passing the New York bar on the first try, right?
So that was in 96. So I became an attorney in 96 in New Jersey and 97 in New York. And I did practice until my son was born. I started doing PI in New York with a firm, Finkelstein and Partners. He's still somebody that I talk to every so often, Finkelstein.
How did you come to relocate to North Carolina?
Your profession usually has to do with also like life, things that happen in life. With my father passed away, my mother was really sad. I decided to go to Puerto Rico and I wanted to spend a couple of months in Puerto Rico, but then I ended up spending 6 years and becoming an attorney in Puerto Rico. Then my ex-husband's job was affected by the construction crash of 94, 95. And he wasn't finding any more work in Puerto Rico. Because when the economy hits the United States, it hits Puerto Rico 10 times worse. He had done everything he could do there. And his family is here in North Carolina. So that was 2010. One of the places I applied to was James Scott Ferrin. So I came to my interview at James Scott Ferrin from Puerto Rico.
Oh, wow. You started with James Scott Ferrin then in 2010 as PI attorney, but you got quickly involved with the community, particularly the Hispanic Latino community, serving as the mayor of Durham, founding member of the mayor of Durham's Hispanic Latino committee, a member of Governor Roy Cooper's Hispanic Latino Council, on the board of Centro Hispano, and of course, as part of NCAJ's Hispanic Latino Legal Issues Division and the DEI committee. When you got here, you had a full-time job, I guess, raising kids and like being a PI attorney. What drove your engagement in the community groups?
I think whenever you've had to work really hard and you had a hard time doing something, because it was not easy to go from not speaking English to then being an attorney, passing the bar in four different states. I mean, it wasn't easy, but it's a struggle first you learn the language and then, you know, everything else that happens and financial struggles and, you know, whatever happens, I think that then you grow a heart towards people that you see are going through the same thing. That's another thing that I mentioned when I was during the award ceremony, that I used to grab the kids on Saturday mornings and go to a church and teach English as a second language. That was the first thing we did, because I felt like we've been able to learn these things. And the people that were taking the ESL classes who had just arrived to the United States, they didn't even know how to say spoon or fork or left or right. And the kids and I would get there early and we would make streets with like whatever we could find. And we would teach them how to give directions, how to order food at a restaurant, how to count money and how to get in the bus, how to follow the bus route. Because people who were coming to these classes had never encountered any of that. They were in refugee camps and things like that. So that's how we began. And then I became more involved, like meeting people in the community. The mayor asked me for help. And I said, let's do it. Let's write some bylaws and create this group. And, you know, people can come here and look for help.
That was a time when the mayor was just forming his Hispanic Latino committee. A lot was changing about North Carolina around that time. And I guess certainly a lot has changed. We have the Hispanic Latino population in North Carolina just continues to grow, like through the years. What were the biggest sort of things that you guys focused on when you started this group? And how has it changed now? I mean, obviously, there's a lot.
Yeah, I think that we see a lot of positive and also, you know, at the federal level, a lot of negative. And how do we continue? How do we get up in the morning and get out of bed with a sense of let's continue growing and let's continue hoping? But I think that that's what happens once you get older and you've been through so many of these changes, you realize you can't stop because things will get better at some point. So at the point when I became involved with the mayor, it was Mayor Bill Bell, and he had a project to work on the track, I think it was track one of the city of Durham, had a great need in this particular community. And whenever they had meetings, no one was showing up from the Latino community, even though there were a large portion of the Latino community. Something that I observed, and I went up to him during one of the meetings and I said, I don't live in this part of town, but we need to get people who live here to come out to these meetings. And I had some suggestions because, you know, at the time of the meeting, it can be our communities working all day and sometimes all night. But if you hold a meeting during working hours, they're not going to come there and they're at their jobs. Also, a very high police presence. Maybe some of these folks are not documented. They might think, what is this about? And then some maybe meetings beforehand, you know, going to their houses and saying, this is what these meetings are about. So I had those suggestions. And he said, I have thought about all of that myself. How do we do it? And so he put me in touch with his people. And then all of us together figured, let's create a group where people feel comfortable coming to, that there's going to be people like them, that they're going to understand the issues. Or maybe that they can be the bridge. Maybe they can come to us and we can come to the meeting. I mean, it took us a good 3 years, maybe more, but we did it.
I've lived in North Carolina all my life, except for a couple of years I spent in Texas in the early 2000s. You know, obviously a huge Hispanic Latino population in Texas. And so I became more familiar with the community. And then I came back to North Carolina, I think in 2004. It just seemed like that the influence, I don't know if the population had expanded or if the cultural influence of Hispanic Latinos in the community had grown, but it seemed like there was a greater voice or a greater opportunity for people to have a voice in some of these things. Whereas when I was growing up, you know, this, I'm sure there were plenty of Hispanic Latinos, but you did not, their representation was not in leadership groups and in community groups was not what I understand it to be now. That's changed a lot since you've been here, right?
Yeah, I think both the community has grown and representation has grown. I think people have come from the north. They have come from, like, even Puerto Ricans. When I came here, I didn't hear. But when Maria happened, the big hurricane, a lot of people came up and they came to North Carolina as well. So there's been a lot of growth. I was also saying at the award how I actually cried tears because at the NCAJ Hispanic Latino group, there was maybe, I know in the executive group, I was the 1%. And then the next year after being one, then there was 4%. And then the next year, and then this year, the reason why I was actually crying was because the door kept opening and more attorneys were coming in and young lawyers were coming in. The things they were saying during the meeting, I was like sitting there thinking, this was my dream. This was what I envisioned. And to see it happen and to see that they're taking up issues, they're actually, you know, right now they're engaged in trying to get members of the Latino community not to use notarios that announce themselves as attorneys. They've taken up this issue because these people are running away with thousands and thousands of dollars and then they disappear. They're not lawyers. So to see the young lawyers that have taken up the leadership positions in within NCAJ and seeing them do these great things, to me, I was sitting there thinking, wow. You know, I'm just excited to continue working with them.
I think I was in a meeting earlier this week with Julie Dambro, our sections divisions person, and she was saying that there's 300 members or so of the Hispanic Latino. Do you know how long the HLD has existed at NCAJ?
It was here when I joined in 2011.
Okay.
Yeah, right after I came into JSF, James Cafferon, I became member and I have been very happy about it every year. I look forward to convention every year. I learn so much. I learn so much about the PI part of, you know, the convention and just making friends, people who support you, people who answer questions. There's, and even the division has a commitment to get students. They're very active in going to all the different law schools and talking to people. Is there any way that we can help you? Is there something that you need? Is there any information that we can provide? Join NCAJ early on. Because if you don't come from a family, like my mom was a social worker, my dad was a teacher, and how would I become involved in a real meaningful way unless I made some friendships? And I found that at NCAJ.
You made a lot of friends in NCAJ, not just in the Hispanic Latino division, but across the board. And you have been a tremendous voice for helping leadership sort of navigate the very unusual time that we are in right now. You talked about the issue of notarios and helping lawyers understand how to help their clients and avoid those things. What are the other challenges that are most pressing for Hispanic Latino division lawyers who serve this community?
Right now, everybody's living in fear, the members of the community, regardless of whether they have status or not. I mean, legal status or documentation or whether they're in process. There's just fear because a lot of people live in mixed families where somebody is in process and somebody is a citizen, or the reality is you could be in a family where there's every kind. And so to live under those conditions where your family could be divided and where you don't know what tomorrow looks like, we have clients who don't want to show up in court. We have, regardless of their status, they don't want to show up. And the fear of driving, fear of going to school, it's to that level. And it is real. For what we have witnessed, some of the work that I do is one of my biggest clients who keeps me very busy is El Centro Hispano. And so they are deep in the mix. You know, the community comes to them and they know of everything that is going on. A lot of the people who were detained were citizens or in process. And so people are scared, and that makes our job more difficult. If we have a client who does not want to come to court, there are ways about that, but that's not the way we envision the justice system to work. I am, because I'm in the diversity group, I am still remaining, and I come to all the meetings. I feel like, I don't know if this is okay, but I call them my kids. I have to see what my children are doing and help in whatever way.
Are you on the executive committee for HLD again this time, as you have been?
Because I'm in the diversity group, I am still remaining, and I come to all the meetings. I feel like, I don't know if this is okay, but I call them my kids. I have to see what my children are doing and help in whatever way.
Right. What do you expect that they'll be taking on? I mean, obviously, there's a huge need for information and communication about the situation, right? Obviously, everyone knows that there is something to be fearful of, but like understanding how that impacts individuals as clients is something that the HLD is uniquely positioned to help with, right?
Yeah. So the attorneys in the group have been very active in informing the community about their rights, always within, you know, legal boundaries. This is what the law is. This is what you can do. This is, for example, for PI, right? Which is what I do the best. You can have an accident, even if you're just visiting, right? If you're here just for a visit and you're a victim of an accident, you have a right to pursue that. Part of my job is informing people that you can have a PI case, that you can have a personal injury case, regardless of your status. That it's not something that should prevent you, that it's not something that should even come up during a trial. A lot of our job is to inform people of what their rights are if they're detained, if they are just stopped for a traffic stop. The organization that I work with helps people prepare their documents in case that there's any reason, not just being detained, but if they fall ill, they can prepare documents that could be ready for any eventuality they have the right to have, because they can continue owning a home. They can continue owning a house, owning a home. And so part of what everyone is doing is informing people and helping them with all of those issues.
I guess I'd like to wrap up with just some reflections from you on what it was like to be honored with the Annie Brown Kennedy Award. What did you think and feel when Courtney let you know that you were going to receive the award?
Part of me said, well, you know, I'm just doing what I'm supposed to do. So, and then to be mentioned with the names of previous recipients was, whoa, that's incredible. And then the third thing was, I feel so good that, you know, the work that we're doing is noticed. And also that NCAJ is choosing to showcase, to show that, you know, there is this situation in the community that is something that we should all know about and find out how we could help. That felt, like I said during my speech, fraternity, not fear. And I was repeating Pope Leo's words.
Thank you so much for all that you do, even if you know it's what you're supposed to do. Not everybody does what they're supposed to do. So thank you. And congratulations again. And thanks for being on the podcast. And thanks to everyone for listening. If you'd like to learn more about NCAJ and all of our sections and divisions, including Hispanic Latino Legal Issues Division, go to ncaj.com/join.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Voices of NCAJ. For more information on the North Carolina Advocates for Justice and how to join or support NCAJ, please visit our website at www.ncaj.com.